What's happening, everybody? Crash Bang Boom Drumming Podcast has itself a triumphant return with a second episode in what I hope to be an ongoing series where I talk to drum manufacturers. And today we have Scott Jenkins of Jenkins Martin Drums. And in hearing those drums played live by some of my friends, I was definitely curious to talk about their shells, the wild history of them, Hal Blaine, Spun Fiberglass, Alan Blay Meyer, the Wrecking Crew, and the way that all those elements, if you will, are connected. So hope you dig it. Crash Bang Boom Podcast can be found on my SoundCloud, YouTube page, as well as iTunes Podcast, Google Play, Podbean, Stitcher, Luminary, and more. Check out my Facebook and Instagram pages for additional content and updates. Please give me a like and or a follow, etc. if you could. Thanks for the support. Shout out to my sponsor, New Orleans Record Press, who's presently pressing a ton of great sounding and looking vinyl, and they do 12 and 7-inch records in both 150 and 180-gram variants. They can help you with everything from design to mastering and electroplating, vinyl coloring options, packaging, and more. So check them out, and that's NewOrleansRecordPress.com. Be on the lookout for your favorite artists offering online lessons, master classes, workshops, and more while amidst this touring downtime. I mean, fuck, it's not like Spotify subscriptions are paying their bills, right? Also be on the lookout for fundraisers, charities, and GoFundMes, and websites like SaveOurStages.com who are looking to save the venues that are feeling the burden in these heavy times. Maybe even buy a snare drum designed by today's guest. You know, who knows? Maybe you'll feel inspired. Help any way you can. All right, everybody, Scott Jenkins of Jenkins Martin Drums. What a wild story. They sound badass. They look fucking fantastic. Here we go. Crash, bang, boom.
Crowds go mad with joy.
All right, Scott Jenkins of Jenkins Martin Drum Company. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing all right, all things considered.
I hear you, man. Thanks for catching up with me. I know I've told you, but I'm definitely a fan of your drums. One of your players, so to speak, is a good friend and co-host of the Crash Bang Boom podcast, and Chris Enriquez. And I remember hearing him playing one of your kits live and being really just impressed with it. And we can definitely get into that. But I am a fan, so it'll be cool to talk to you about the history of the company and just what's been going on and all that. To start off with, man, how are y'all faring during these COVID times in which we find ourselves, man? I know I spoke to Jeremy at Q Drums, and he was saying while it's been a little slow, one of the positive aspects of it is that in people's downtime, they're quite possibly more willing to even buy a snare drum or something to give them extra inspiration.
Yeah.
So what has been your experience in dealing with this and the manufacturing process and everything else?
Yeah, I'm getting kind of the same vibe where they might be broke because of, you know, their day jobs or their musical careers going down the tube.
Yeah.
But they do want to experiment. They need something to keep them entertained, and they're buying snare drums. And it just so happened that my partner, David Martin, he ended up moving the shop out of our old location.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to have some downtime anyway. And I had a stack of shells cut off. He sends me large tubes, mm-hmm. and I cut them into different lengths. And so we had a stack of those and just said, well, let's have a moving sale. And right when he started looking for a new place to set up, you know, this stuff hit and people weren't showing buildings. Various things conspired against us in finding a new place. So we have actually just been selling snare drums, and they're moving fairly well.
Nice.
Not making a ton of money, and you know, the whole company is more of a labor of love at this point.
Yeah,
but it's been fine. I can't complain, all things considered.
So
just sticking to building what we have in stock. He has, I think, found a new place to set up, and we'll be starting to wind drum pull kits again. And that's good because we're getting orders backed up.
Gotcha. Well, where were y'all located previously, and where are the two of you now located in separate places?
So I live in Columbia, Missouri, which is where the university is located. Mm. And he lives in basically Cleveland. And so he's staying in Cleveland. I tried to talk into moving here, but didn't work out.
Yeah.
But he's just moving from one location to another. Long story short, he was in a business, a family business, and left that, and that's where the shop was located.
Gotcha.
And just needs to find a new location.
Gotcha, man. Well, how long have y'all been making these Jenkins Martin drums? Tell me a little bit about the origins of the company. I know you've got the Blamire Shell sort of inheritance, so to speak, that's at the origins of it. So
yeah.
Give me a little rundown of the history of the company and maybe how long y'all have been making drums.
So Alan Blamire started it in 1962, basically, is what we've narrowed it down to. My dad talked to him. He worked for the Naval Undersea Center in Pasadena, California.
Mm-hmm.
He had Parkinson's disease, and my dad was talking to him.
Mm.
So his information was kind of rough. But basically, he worked with anti-submarine missile technologies.
Wow.
We're guessing that he saw some tubes in these ships that were made out of this, you know, spun fiberglass, and decided he would like to see how that would work out in an acoustic manner.
Wow.
And yeah, so I don't know if he was tapping on them one day and thought, well, this sounds cool and it's resonating or what, but.
Yeah, right.
So he started wanting them, I think, in 1962.
Mm.
Started just selling shells and wrap. You know, he was not really interested in making shells that were pretty.
Mm-hmm.
He bought whatever resin was on sale that week. So you'll see green, yellow, brown, pink, you know, different colors of resin in the shells. And he sold them with wrap, with the intent of them being wrapped.
Right.
He was not building drums. He was selling shells. And then the shops or builders would buy them from him and put whatever hardware they could. Because at the time, you could buy Rogers hardware, Ludwig hardware, Camco hardware. So they weren't Blamire drum sets, per se, but they were just the shells.
Right.
He did that for a while and ended up sometime in the 70s, maybe early 80s, he quit making them for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't doing much of them. So fast forward to around 2008.
Mm-hmm.
My dad out in California, his neighbor's getting a divorce and has a bunch of stuff out on the lawn, including a drum set, looks like a Ludwig set. And my dad sent my brother over there and said, hey, why don't you go give him $100 for that kit so we can strip the hardware off of it? Because he mm-hmm. could tell it wasn't a Ludwig, but he just wanted the hardware.
Yeah.
So he did that. And I think the guy, he may have just given it to him because he was going to take it to Goodwill or something. Turns out, so he starts tearing it apart and he sees these green shells on the inside and, of course, realizes they're fiberglass and it's got the guy's name on a piece of paper embedded in the resin on the inside of it. Looks him up and somehow contacts his wife and says, you know, what's the deal? Like, tell me about, you know, these shells. And I guess he'd previously talked to Joe Voda, drum store owner, and he said, yeah, Alan Cicello's back in the day.
Wow.
So he contacted the wife and said, you know, what can you tell me about these shells? What can you tell me about, you know, Alan and what, how he did this? And she said, well, you want to talk to him? And I guess he assumed he was dead.
Right.
Yeah. So that started a relationship between the two of them. And my dad, in the meantime, had been tracking down every Blamire shell he could find and started restoring these kits or making new kits out of old stock shells he found.
Wow.
And this is probably 2008, 2009. And he kind of just was unearthing all the information he could about these things,
mm-hmm.
partially because, you know, he quickly realized this was part of the monster kit that Hal Blaine played.
Right.
And was therefore a significant part of musical history.
Yeah.
In the meantime, my dad had decided, like, you know, I want to start making these again. This is a great shell. He loved the sounds he was getting out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I believe, through one of the drum forums, met David. And David at the time was making carbon fiber shells.
Right.
And had an understanding and worked in the industry with fiberglass and synthetics in general. And was like, you know, trying to figure out if David could make the shells for him. They started kind of going through the process of figuring out how they were made. Alan kind of knew, but a lot of it had escaped him. And he also kind of put it on my dad, you know, he said, I figured this out. You can figure it out.
Wow.
He told him bits and pieces, but he didn't lay the whole thing out for him. I don't know if he could.
Mm-hmm.
But they got, you know, chemical analysis. They tracked down the original filament and started developing these shells. And at a certain point, David just said, you know, I'm not going to be your supplier. We're going to be partners.
Wow.
That was kind of the beginning of the actual Jenkins Barton Drum Company.
And what year was that about?
2010.
Okay.
And around that time, I think my dad was already friends with John Schwartz, a.k.a. Bermuda Schwartz, Weird Al's drummer.
Mm-hmm.
And Bermuda was a ConcertCon fanatic and, loved Hal Blaine and kind of commissioned a kit, a ConcertCon set in the style of Hal Blaine. And that was the official, first project of building these new shells under the Blaymeyer / Jenkins Martin name.
Yeah.
Hal had a 7-piece that John wanted to add, I think the 15 to it. And actually, my dad didn't want to do a 15, but Bermuda talked him into doing it, said, I'll pay for whatever the mold is, so
yeah.
I can have that. So anybody who in the future gets a 15 owes it to Bermuda. But
right.
Anyway, they put that kit together and they built another, like a 4-piece, 1-up, 2-down kit and debuted those at the 2012 Chicago Drum Show.
Mm.
That was kind of the official start. So,
wow.
And we've been going since then. So the official start 2012, but they started developing in 2010.
Yeah. Well, once you get sort of the Blaymeyer shell formula down, what did the manufacturing process then entail? It sounds like your dad was working on some of this stuff and sort of figuring out how to make some of these shells. But that sounds more like he was acquiring the Blaymeyer shells, and then Jenkins Martin. It was time. Then you were like, all right, now we need to replicate this, right?
Right. And so Alan wound these shells in his garage. It was a hand crank scenario. He had different sized mandrels, which is a metal tube that they're wound from the inside out. It goes on almost like a bobbin or a fishing reel. It goes back and forth and around. And David experimented with, that stuff and was getting it figured out, but at a certain point decided, we got to automate this. And he actually engineered a machine that,
wow.
Wound these shells. And, with his background and all this stuff, they're wound under tension, which is part of what creates the energy and the resonance that they have.
So with wood shells, you have plies. They have their way of conforming those shells. And then,
mm-hmm.
with metal drums, for instance, you'd like pour it into a mold.
Or bend it, yeah.
Yeah, or bend it. Yeah, exactly. Is there a mold that this goes into, or is the spinning the process that, how does that work?
It doesn't go into a mold. So, and we try to explain that to people as much as we can, because there is a negative connotation of fiberglass because of some of the manufacturers and their methods of creating it. Some of them did have a mold that they would kind of take either a woven mat that
mm-hmm.
they would impregnate with the resin and lay it into this form and let
mm-hmm.
it cure, or some would blow it in. I think Pearl would have a blown, what's called, chopped glass,
mm-hmm.
Which is what you would see on a like a boat hull or something. These are, you have a long cylinder, and it is the interior diameter of the shell.
Gotcha.
And so then David has these spools of the filament that come together, and they go through a comb system that straightens them out and flattens them into a kind of a like a ribbon width, and it goes through a resin bath, and then the machine pulls it back and forth across this mandrel as it's spinning.
Mm.
There's a specified amount of tension put on it, and then once he gets it to a certain thickness, he cuts that, and it goes up into a heating element that helps cure it. And then he has to hang that tuba, this crazy contraption, that he built, and then it has a collar that goes to the top and like just rips the thing off the cylinder, because it kind of, as it cures, it gets really, really tight around this cylinder, and it's also wound under tension, so
mm-hmm.
once he pulls that off, he's got a 20-inch tube of these of this shell material that I can cut up into the various lengths.
Wow.
He shifts me the tubes. They're about twice as thick as what they end up at, because the process creates kind of a rough exterior, and I have to sand them down, which is an incredible amount of labor. which I'm trying to figure out a machine to help me in that area.
Yeah, right.
So they're very different than the typical fiberglass shell. They have a lot more of resonance. They have a lot more. They have a kind of a woody musical note to them because of how dense the material is and how thin it is. They have a lower fundamental note.
Right.
And because of the way that the fiberglass and the resin, what I understand is that at a certain level, they become a single unit of material. So it's a true seamless shell. And because of the orientation of the grain in that, it carries the sound, you know, all throughout the shell instead of straight down through it and out of it.
Right.
Which is different than what you would get in a wood drum. And wood drums are typically, you know, they typically have a seam. They're typically either a ply that's wrapped around and lapped and cleaned up, or there's a bent one where there's a seam. The only ones that wouldn't would be, the crazy hollowed out log ones.
Right.
But, you know, those are kind of impractical over time. The wood tends to crack in that orientation, so...
It was interesting for me because I have an older acrylic kit. I have a Vistalite pre-75. Mm-hmm. And so when I heard you were making fiberglass drums, sort of I thought, oh, well, I'm assuming like the tonality will be kind of similar. So again, I was really interested to hear it. But when I heard it, I was like, this is actually, to my ear, more focused.
Yeah.
Has more low end and is quite possibly even louder.
Yeah.
So I was surprised. I was really surprised.
Very loud.
And, I mean, have you by any chance A-bead like an acrylic kit and one of those to ever really hear them? I own one, so I knew when I heard it just acoustically without mics, I was like, I know what this drum set's doing.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was damn impressed with it. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I have not. I have not sat down to an acrylic kit in a long time.
Yeah.
I always wanted one. I always, you know, John Bonham
of
played
course.
Them and they just look freaking cool. The first time I sat down to one was after I had played these drums, and I
yeah.
was disappointed. They have a sound that they make, and it is a cool sound. They have a very limited
totally
spectrum of that. You know, when you hit that sweet spot and you get that everything set right,
mm-hmm.
if you want that sound, it's perfect. But there's not much room for variation in it.
Right.
And it's more of a very, very short note.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what heads you put them, you can get
yep.
a short note, but typically what it does is it gives you its tone and then it drops off.
Yeah, quicker decay for sure. And it's wild too, because I've spoken about it as well, you know, with those older Vistalites, and like I said, mine's pre-75. They were still trying to figure out some things, and the bearing edges aren't the most consistent, and they were really trying to work it out. And as you said, I think they are kind of a one-trick pony, and they do that one thing really well. But I think what's interesting about your kit is that I think it just provides more of a variety in what you can get out of it. But speaking of heads, is there a particular head? And of course, it's particular to what you're going for. But have you found a particular head that you think sounds especially good to your ear on those kits you make?
Because of the ability of the shells to, you know, they create a lot of the sound, more so than a lot of other drums.
Right.
You can put just about anything on them. But
mm-hmm.
that said, I do find that on the resonant side, the Evans EC Rezo, which
mm-hmm.
is a clear single ply, and it's got kind of that painted on stripe around it.
Yep.
Gives the best, you know, combination of sound on the bottom. And on top, we tend to go with the EC2s, just a clear two ply,
mm-hmm.
or a G2.
Yep.
G2, which is a coated two ply.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably what we see most on them. If it's a rock and roll or jazz, you know, most of those guys are using either the single ply or two ply coated.
Mm-hmm.
The guys like Chris Enriquez and Brian St. Pierre and those guys, they're using two ply
yep.
clear heads, but typically EC2s, the edge control, you know, kind of reigns in the drums just a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, if you dig into them, they really just start singing.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Sounds so good, man. Well, with the Blaymeyer shells, did you get any info as to what, if he had a particular bearing edge that was preferable, and did that transfer into what bearing edges y'all prefer with these drums?
Yeah, we're fairly limited, actually. You know, I mean, the shell is an eighth of an inch thick. There's not a whole lot you can do there as far as variation. But what we saw in general was a what I call a bullnose. It's, you know, a round over on the inside and the outside.
Gotcha.
And, you know, the only really variation you could do there would be to make a larger outside one and have it just kind of straight on the inside. But what I do is I have a router bit that cuts just a hair over the half of it, you know, the 16th. And so I cut the inside first and then I cut the outside second, and it makes the round over slightly larger on the outside of it and doesn't make a peak, but it has more of that kind of, it's like a mini Camco. I don't know if you've seen that one, but so yeah, it's just a rounded over, full round over.
Gotcha.
I level that out and make sure that it's, you know, flat across there, and that's it.
Yeah. Is that essentially is most commonly called a reverse round over, and then you just have a little bit of a flat edge on the top of it where the head would sit? Is that what it is, or is it totally kind of just rounded over?
There is just ever so slight flatness to it.
Yeah.
Primarily because, you know, on such a small scale like that, you would err towards having the top of the shell level as opposed to trying to get that perfect round over all the way around.
For sure.
You know, it's so by flat, I mean, I couldn't even measure how wide it is. It's so small, but, I round it over, I smooth everything out, and I flatten it. And if I have to, I round it a little bit more.
Gotcha.
It's a process.
Yeah, dude. Sounds like it.
But, I obsess about every one of them.
Yeah, man. Well, that actually explains a little bit of the low end, and between the what the shells are made of and the tonality that they have within themselves and that bearing edge, that kind of confirms, I think, to me, what my ears were hearing with the low end and the warmth of it and the you know, the whole thing. So that's interesting to hear that.
Yeah, they carry, you know, a lower fundamental note, and a lot of times I actually encourage people to go, you know, if you feel like if you're torn between a 20 and a 22, get the 20 because, you know, it's smaller and you can set up more stuff around it, it's going to hit like a 22 would, you know. We don't currently make a 26. We haven't built a mender for it, but I always, the people that ask, I say, try the 24.
Yeah, right. Totally.
And when Brian St. Pierre was looking at a kit, he was kind of vacillating between a 22 and a 24. And I said, what are you comfortable with? Said 22. So he got that, and you know, he was blown away and bought a full kit.
Nice. Yeah. He spoke very highly of it when I spoke to him as well. Let me ask you this. So, I guess in addition, so we've talked kind of about getting the shells together and bearing edges and this and that and the other, I guess, then there's the hardware side of it. Tell me a little bit about the process of determining lugs and rims and, you know, throws for the snare, butt plates, et cetera, just the kind of hardware, assimilation of getting those drums together on that end.
When you go back to the original Blamers, like I said, it was whatever the builder decided they were going to do. But at a certain point, Alan decided he wanted to kind of dip his toes into that that world and started designing his own lugs. And they didn't end up on very many drums. I think it was kind of towards the end of his, you know, time building them. But you can find them. And, you know, my dad found them. And when it came time to, you know, get the company put together, they decided to replicate those. So they found a manufacturer, you know, to make as high quality as lug as you can make today. And so we have those proprietary lugs. As far as the rest of the hardware, like 95% of the other builders in the world, we are basically using whatever, you know, we can find that fits our needs through the drum supply companies. To try and develop our own hoops and tom mounts, you know, well, eventually we'd like to develop our own tom mounts.
Right.
But the upfront cost of those are astronomical. And you know, you have to develop it and make sure that's what you want. Because when they make the mold and it costs you five figures, if you don't like it, well, you're out of luck.
Yeah, right.
So we just basically, you know, make sure that we find the highest quality that we can get in the hoops and then the floor tom legs. And we have, you know, what we are our standard hardware, but then we occasionally will cater to a customer's needs if they want to do a like a REMS type mount or something different like that.
Right.
Because we are a full custom company.
Mm-hmm.
So we can do that sort of thing.
Awesome, man. Well, out of curiosity, I know in looking at just sort of the badge of the drums, they appear to be similar, but you have the Blaymeyer badge drums and then you have the Jenkins Martin badge drums. To my eye, it just appears that it's the color that's the difference. Is there a physical difference between the two?
Basically, the Blaymeyer drums are the original color, the original mix, and only those drums can have the Blaymeyer badge. It's more of a, they all sound the same. Put that out there, but basically the only difference would be in the Jenkins Martin we incorporate different coloring agents or mica powders or sparkle flake, you know, that kind of stuff in there.
Yeah.
Into the resin during the process, so it's, you know, it's all the way through the shell.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only difference, you know. Anything that gets that stuff in it then is badged Jenkins Martin.
Gotcha.
And if you look at the Blaymeyer badge, it says Blaymeyer real tiny by Jenkins Martin. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do you have a favorite of what Jenkins Martin has produced thus far? I know I saw a recent post where you were calling something that looked kind of similar in its color to the Blaymeyer thing, and talking about calling it sea glass. And I love that color. And it looked like it was slightly translucent as well. Do you have any is snare, tom, the bass, or any particular thing that you've done where you really especially loved it?
Yeah, I mean, several, and I can't, this is a major problem because, you know, our choices are almost unlimited because we have these sources of different metallic powders and you know, flakes and whatnot that we can do, and I can't settle on one that I want for myself.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, some of the cool ones we've done recently are that clear one, which, you know, I want to make even more clear, more of kind of a soda bottle.
Right.
Kind of look.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's one that's like a dark gray metallic powder.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's awesome.
There's one that's kind of a moss green metallic.
Yeah. They're really cool colors, man.
One that I built for myself recently and we did a kit of is basalt, which is actually a different filament.
Mm.
And there's no coloring. We don't add color to it, but the color of the actual filament strand is a dark black, but it has kind of these gold and brown streaks in it.
Wow.
And it's actually created from a volcanic rock.
Whoa.
Similar to how you would make glass. They melt it down and they pull it into a filament strand.
Mm-hmm.
And so made a very limited number of those and would like to make more, but it's kind of hard to come by. So we'll see what happens.
Absolutely.
And you know, the Blaymeyer color, I keep thinking I'm going to get sick of it, but I never do. It's just,
I love it.
It's a really cool color. And, you know, on stage, it takes whatever color the lights are. It is semi-opaque, you know, so you can kind of see light through it. So I just love that color.
Yeah. Well, in speaking about, I guess, the Blaymeyer design and its association with Hal Blaine, epic drummer, and of course, those listening to this can look at his history with the Wrecking Crew, and, you know, that collective, as well as him especially, played on seemingly everyone's albums, just a shocking amount of recordings that he did. And I would imagine, since he was kind of based primarily out of a studio, a single studio for a good bit of that stuff, do you know if a lot of those recordings that he was on, that he was playing that Blaymeyer kit?
That kit was built in 1967.
Mm.
And at the time, you know, Hal was kind of experimenting with his drums, had a couple of timbales made into concert toms, or toms, and loved that sound. And, you know, over time, him and his guitar tech, you know, found these shells through a pro drum shop and built the kit. Once they, you know, debuted this kit, you know, people went nuts over it. And we're just demanding, you know, you got to bring this big kit. And he actually had two of them built because he was jumping around from job to job so quickly that they didn't even have time to move them.
Wow.
And, you know, a funny story behind that is some of the studios swore that the kit number one, the first one that was built, sounded better than the second one.
Hmm.
And so they were like, you know, you got to bring kit number one. So he actually labeled both of them kit number one so that they didn't know and he didn't have to move them as much. But
nice.
To answer your question, I've gotten to think that they were on a lot of those recordings because, you know, they're so versatile and, you know, with that many toms in front of you, whatever sound you're wanting to find, you know, you're going to.
Mm-hmm.
There are guys who would probably know more about what exactly, or, you know, what songs are likely to have them on. There's some that are very obvious.
Yeah.
Just from hearing them. Yeah, they had to be on just thousands of recordings.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of times people come up to me and they say, you know, I've never heard these, you know, what are they? And I said, well, you have, you just didn't know it.
Yeah, totally.
They're all over everything.
Totally. And it's interesting because I like to, when I was talking to Jeremy over at Q Drums, I was asking if there was any particular recordings or whatever that he resorted to in designing their drums. But it's a totally different thing with you because the drums that you were designing are on thousands of recordings, as you say. And literally, right. If you look at Hal Blaine's Wikipedia page, he's playing those toms. And like you said, they're concert toms. It's a, you know, 7-8-piece kit or something. He's got toms for days.
Right.
But it's a picture of him at the recording or at the record plant rather. But yeah, man, that's cool that you would potentially have that history that preceded the drums that you would inevitably go on to design, you know?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, it's really hard to tell. They were a secret weapon, you know.
Yeah.
Whenever this was going on, you know, they had Ludwig lugs on it. So everyone assumed that they were Ludwigs. And, you know, at the time, there was a lot of players that were kind of sneaking these shells underneath whatever drum company they were playing for because they wanted the shell. They heard Hal's kit. But, you know, Slingerland or whoever didn't want them to be playing somebody else's drums. So you get a guy like Louis Belson had a snare that he had wrapped, a Blame Iron snare that he had wrapped. I can't remember. It was Rogers, maybe.
Yeah.
I think it was Rogers. He had it wrapped and, you know, a Rogers White Marine Pearl, and he had the Rogers lugs put on it. But underneath it all, it was a Blame Iron.
Wow.
So, you know, who knows what all recordings had these things on them.
Totally.
Without having any sort of information about that.
Yeah. Wow, man.
Dennis Wilson had, you know, a kit made for him, and it was set up in his studio for a long time, and tons of people went to that studio, and you know, but, you know, no one writes down or takes pictures of what's going on in there. So
sure.
It's really hard to tell, but they're out there.
Wow, man. What are y'all using for rims generally on the toms and even the snares? Are y'all doing die cast on one and not the other, or doing flanged, sort of standard flanged, triple flanged, I guess is one of the more common ones?
We're typically doing the heavier 2.3 millimeter triple flange.
Gotcha.
That's just standard.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're starting to get some requests for the die cast because, you know, guys like Brian and Jason Gherkin, you know, have been putting those on there and to great effect. So because of that, we're starting to get some requests and yeah, we'll put those on there.
In those instances, were they talking more about having die cast on the snare and the triple flange that you're using on the toms, or die cast across the board?
Well, initially just the snare, but Brian has gone to doing them all across the whole kit.
Wow.
But, you know, that guy, he hits drums.
I know.
Well, I don't know if you've been in the same room with him in an acoustic drum set, but God, it's unbelievable. When I first took a kit over to his house, went to his living room, and I'm kind of setting up the kit around him, and he's talking, you know, and he hits the rack tom, a 12-inch rack tom next to my head, and I thought a cannon had gone off. You know, the guy just...
Oh, my God.
Annihilates drums, and I remember seeing his snare after they did a show in Tolano, and, you know, the head is just caved in, you know, after one
Jesus,
show.
Jesus, that's crazy.
So, yeah, it's insane. So it was kind of a match made in heaven, you know.
Right.
These drums initially, you know, a lot of guys who were into Hal Blaine and the older, you know, kind of vintage drum thing were into them. But, you know, once I started hearing them, I thought, man, you know, these things are so loud and so,
yeah,
but have, you know, this character to them. I got to get these to the heavy hitters out there, and
yeah,
as they get a hold of them, they're just loving them. You know, you put a guy like Chris Enriquez behind this kit, and it's, you know, it's deadly.
Totally. That's when I heard it. I was like, well, goddamn, that shit sounds awesome. Oh man, that is so cool. I mean, in Brian's case, because he's such a smasher, I could see him putting mm-hmm. die cast on everything. But for the Toms in particular, I think the resonance is already so good and the decay is already there. For me personally, I wouldn't add to it. So in my mind, right. I think doing the triple flange would be the way to go, especially on the Toms. And it sounds like that's what y'all do. And that's what sure. I've heard. And it sounded great. So it all makes sense. Well, you as a drummer, man, what's your story? It sounds like your dad was into drums. You have a brother as well that's involved with the company, I'm assuming, was into drums. You sound like a drumming family. What was your life like growing up? Was there just drums everywhere? What's going on here?
Yeah, well, my parents were divorced fairly early, and you know, my dad was a drummer and my mom was not.
Yeah.
And I always wanted drums, you know, because dad had them, but she wouldn't let me get them. You know, she encouraged my musical side. I got a guitar. Mm-hmm. But I only got to play the drums when I went to dad's house. But I had the typical, you know, 5-year-old Tupperware drum set. And, you know, I got really good at air drums.
Yeah.
Really good. And it was something that I always enjoyed doing, you know, but I ended up kind of playing guitar more mm-hmm. and playing drums when I could. I never got to have my own kits, but I was in a lot of bands. You know, I played music a lot, and right. I was constantly annoying my drummers by in between songs, you know, pushing them out of the seat and playing their drums.
Yeah.
So I got to play, and in some of our bands, you know, we would do fun little shows and where we switched instruments, and I yep. always demanded I was the drummer.
Yeah, of course.
And as I started helping, you know, my dad build these drums, I eventually started getting my own stuff. One of my old drummers had a kit laying around that I just kind of snagged for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my first personal kit didn't really happen until about 2011.
Wow. Look at you.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You were around so, them constantly.
Yeah. Well, and you know, they were just always kind of there too. If I go to my dad's house, he had 2 or 3 drum sets set up.
Yeah.
So, but just being a musician, I've always had them around. And now that, you know, I have my own all over the place, my guitar is collecting dust.
Oh my God. Well, did you or your brother, did any of y'all go to the school for engineering or anything like that? Or was it just kind of a learn on the job, trial by fire?
Yeah. Well, my dad and myself are both mechanically inclined mm-hmm. naturally or through our environment.
Yeah.
I, at an early age, started doing woodworking. I was a carpenter. Ran a woodworking and cabinet shop for 20 years.
Wow. There you go.
And so, you know, when he was developing these drums, he was, you know, mechanically inclined as well, but he would still, you know, kind of hit me up for advice on, you know, how do I drill this? I'm having this problem. This is cracking, mm-hmm. et cetera. And I would, you know, kind of walk him through that. He sent me a few shells to mess around with. And coincidentally, at the time, I was taking an interest in building drums. I was looking at building wood. I didn't have fiberglass around me
mm-hmm.
and I took a few attempts at making them, but you know, that outside of making stave drums, you know, making wood shells is a whole different ballgame.
Oh yeah,
you know,
dude.
It's really hard to make that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And once I heard these, I kind of lost interest in that. But
yeah,
you know, I went out there and started helping him, and it did kind of come naturally to me because I had that background of working with my hands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it came real natural. And you know, after a while, you know, my dad was dealing with cancer, and mm-hmm. when he was building them, at a certain point, he wasn't able to do it anymore.
Yeah.
The orders were kind of stacking up, and I told him one day, I said, you know, well, I'm going to come out there and get the tools from you. Just start yeah. doing it.
Wow.
And he said, come on out, come get him, you know.
Mm.
And he never wanted to ask me to do it. He didn't, you know, want to put that on me.
Mm-hmm.
But I love doing it. It's just a completely random set of circumstances that led to me ending up doing this
yeah.
as a career. But I love it. It's been kind of amazing meeting some of my, you know, favorite drummers through all this.
Sure.
The drum community is so wonderful. You know, I call some of these people up out of the blue, and they just, you know, they just want to talk shop for an hour.
Right.
it's been great.
Nice.
And I want to keep doing it, and we want to keep developing newer and better drums, and but keep that kind of pure shell technology at the core of it.
Absolutely. That is your hallmark, and it is super unique and sounds awesome, and it looks beautiful. So as far as I can tell, you're firing on all cylinders in that regard. So definitely best of luck going forward, especially in these kind of trying times. But I think the product is there, and I definitely hope more people can get their hands on them and check them out, because they definitely sound and look amazing. So congrats on that.
Thank you.
Yeah, man. Well, Scott, it was good talking to you, man. Thanks for running me through the history of the company and telling me about your family ties to it, and the Hal Blaine and Blaymeyer and all of that intertwined and all of it. It was a cool journey. And yeah, we'll have to catch up soon. If I'm ever in your neck of the woods, I'll have to catch up with you. I'd love to see some of this stuff in person, man. It's super fascinating.
Yeah, stop by.
Right on, man. Great talking to you. And we'll talk soon, man.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
All right, everybody, thanks for hanging as always. Always appreciate the repeated listens, and if you are new to this, then I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Scott Jenkins for rapping, and one of these days, plan on getting my hands on at least a snare, if not a whole kit. What a great story it was, hearing the history of it all. We'll catch you all in the next one. Crash, bang, boom!